You're listening to the Cycling Podcast at the Vuelta a España in association with Rafa. Today we are in Camperona.
Hello, my name's Richard Moore. I'm standing on top of La Camperona with Daniel Freeb.
Hello, Richard.
Stunning place, this, isn't it?
The days passed, your pronunciation of my surname doesn't improve. Anyway.
At least I got Camperona right.
I still don't understand the beef in my pronunciation of Jono Groats. Jono Groats. Anyway.
That's last night's controversy, Daniel. We'll move on. Daniel Freeba, well, here we are on top of this stunning little climb. Where are we now, Daniel?
We're about 25 kilometres from León, I think. About 25, 30 kilometres from León.
So we've been dipping into different regions of Spain, haven't we, over the last couple of days?
Sort of under the left armpit now of Spain.
And it's a really quite a strange, surreal place, isn't it? A really short 2.5 kilometer climb up to here. We were wondering as we drove up just why there's a road here.
Did we get a good answer on that?
Not really, but there are a lot of mass, so I think it's something to do with that. This is the highest point for several miles because we're surrounded by nice. Spanish plains. Well, those mountains there are quite a long way away.
What are you talking? Is this the cycling podcast or I stumbled onto something? The miles?
Kilometers. Anyway, tale of the etapa. Well, once again, a huge breakaway went clear and once again it contained lots of very good riders, which really puts the pressure on behind and it gave the guys in the bunch behind a hard day. They left the chase a little bit too late, in particular, Astana and Movistar were quite active trying to bring things back together, but they left it a bit too late. But in that move were the likes of Gorka Izagirre, Dylan Teuns, once again, fourth day in a row that he was in the break, Marcus Burkhardt, Rafał Majka, Jay McCarthy, all from Bora Hansgrohe. They did a power of work to try and set it up for Majka. Thomas De Gendt, of course, was there, one of, I think, four or five riders for Lotto Soudal. Laurence De Plus was there, Ben King was there once again, Mahawi Kudus, Ilner Zakarin, Sergio Henao, Balcom Mollema. It was a real quality group, Luis Angel Mate as well. Real quality group, and on one of the King of the Mountains climbs at Puerto de Tarna, after 105 kilometres, De Gendt was first at the top, followed by King and Luis Angel Mate. And King is closing a little bit on Luis Angel Mate in the King of the Mountains competition. We'll hear from him a little bit later in the episode. But on this final climb up to the finish, it was all set up nicely for Rafał Majka. He was the first to attack. Mahawi Kudus tried to go with him, did go with him. Paid a bit for the effort, dropped back. Dylan Teuns judged it a little bit better. He caught with Majka. But then Oscar Rodriguez, a Spanish rider on Euskadi Murias' team, he came from nowhere and went past the pair of them and certainly caught Majka by surprise, and he won the stage. We'll hear more from about him because Fran Reyes knows him extremely well. He used to ride for the under-23 team that Fran is involved with.
From grand tours to group rides, the Champs-Élysées to coffee shops, Rafa exists to celebrate the world's most beautiful sport.
Thank you very much to our headline sponsor, Rafa, and a reminder that Rafa hosts regular rides every day of the week from more than 20 clubhouses around the world. Visit rafa.cc to find your local ride. One ride I will mention today, it's not really a ride, it's a cyclocross skills clinic in Boulder. And it's about learning some of the basics of cross or brushing up on your skills, such as dismounts, cornering, barriers, mock racing. I actually saw a very good bit of cyclocross skills today from Joey Roscoff when he had a puncture. I think he had to have some mechanical attention to his bike, and he did a very, very cool cyclocross style dismount. Anyway, the cyclocross skills clinic happens at Rafa Boulder. There's been one already on September the 5th. There's another one on September the 12th. That's next week, and that's 5 p.m. meet at Rafa Boulder, and it's aimed at beginner to intermediate level. So, Daniel, what did we learn from today?
That you are the tale of the etapa's equivalent or answer to Mystical, the 1990s and noughties rapper, the fastest rhymer in the rap game, Rich.
I forgot to say who was leading the race overall, and it's still Jesus Herrada. I know Jesus Herrada.
I asked Jesus Herrada if, like Jesus Christ, if he was capable of performing miracles after the stage, and he said no. He thought it would need to be God, not Jesus, to keep the jersey over the next few days.
Did didn't look too good for him today. He did get dropped quite early on the climb, but it's such a short climb that he was still able to just lose a minute and a half, and so he remains a minute and a half ahead. But with two difficult mountain days to come, I wouldn't bet too much money on him holding it for too much longer. We'll talk about the stage winner a little bit later with Fran, but what did we learn from the battle behind? I mean, Nairo Quintana, Simon Yates were the two who emerged at the front. Superman Lopez had problems with his bike. He was off his bike. He lost, I think, 20 seconds in there.
Also, skipped the mix zone. He's going to get fined for that. Slithered out of the mix zone or didn't even stop at the mix zone, which he is obliged to do as the leader of the Young Riders classification.
Well, what was he not? I take it he wasn't too happy.
I guess so. I mean, he was up here quite a long time, but he was sort of hiding. Simon Yates was also hiding behind a truck. No one spotted him. Did they?
No.
We did.
You spotted him.
I interviewed him, but I got the impression that no one else knew where he was hiding. He was stowed away behind a lorry, as I say.
Well, it's a funny climb, isn't it? And it's so steep, and it's clearly going to suit the pure climbers like Quintana and Simon Yates. Wilco Kelderman looked pretty good for a while there, and my podium, which I predicted last night in this Vuelta, is Quintana, Superman Lopez and Kelderman. But I'm not so sure about that now, and Simon Yates is surprising me by looking very strong, although he did lose a little bit to Quintana right at the end. Quintana put in a bit of a burst, and you know, I think just he's been looking quite frisky, I think, Quintana.
Oh, well, Quintana's been looking very frisky, but one interesting thing that Simon Yates said at the finish, he doesn't necessarily give a lot away in interviews. You have to sort of pour over the fine print of what he says, but he did remark that, well, I asked him whether the handbrake was now completely off, because he's been talking a lot about this instruction he's had not to ride too aggressively, and he said, well, no, not quite. So giving the impression that he was still not going too far into the red today.
Did he describe the climb as filthy?
No.
He's been doing that a lot. He's been using that word a lot. Don't know where he's picked it up.
Good word. Did you speak to Wilco Kelderman?
No.
I did. I'd forgotten that. I've just remembered I did speak to him. And for the first time in this Vuelta, I interviewed him and he didn't swear. He said it wasn't his climb. And that was the conclusion he'd drawn by the end of the climb, by the time he'd been dropped, because like you say, he had started pretty well. But he is going really well, and he says his legs feel fantastic.
He is, and certainly I think a climb like Lagos de Covadonga, for example, on Sunday will suit him much better. It's much longer, it's quite steep in places, but it's longer. It's the type of climb that would suit a time trialist climber like him.
It is, although, you know, it's sometimes described as the Vuelta's equivalent of Alpe d'Huez, partly because it's, for a long time, it was the closest thing the Vuelta had to a sort of iconic climb, discovered in 1984, wasn't it? Or first used in the Vuelta in 1984. And
that's Luis Herrera won.
Bernardino won.
No, Luis Herrera won. Eno won. No, he didn't. No, Bernardino Eno didn't win the Vuelta that year.
But he won on Lagos de Covadonga.
I think Herrera won on Lagos de Covadonga.
I think not, Rich, because it was. I'm gonna check this. We're gonna check this, obviously. But the Lagos de Covadonga, one of the. Well, back then, in fact, they weren't referred to in the press as Lagos de Covadonga. They were referred to as the Lagos de Enol in the reports on the race, and one or more of the newspapers did a bit of a play on words, and they said no, it was the Lagos de Eno, not Enol.
You can dress this up all you like, Daniel, but I'm pretty sure you're wrong, and we will check this, but you know, we'll keep this in just to expose ourselves to possible ridicule.
Anyway, it's sometimes described as the Alpe d'Huez of the Vuelta. However, that's a bit misleading, because it's a little bit shorter, I think, than that. I've probably got that wrong as well, than Alpe d'Huez, but it's more irregular than Alpe d'Huez. Alpe d'Huez is a very constant sort of 8-7% gradient. Lagos de Covadonga is not like that. There are some really steep ramps.
Really, we're really. This is a masterclass. And are you going to check this now?
Okay, go for it. Talk about something. Amuse yourself. Talk amongst yourselves.
What I will say, Daniel. Well, let's hear from Ben King while you're checking this, because I spoke to Ben King at the finish, and he spoke very interestingly. But what was very clear was the effort from today. It was a very, very, very hard day, and you know, when the race unfolds like it has done today, and in fact the 2 days prior to this, with a very strong big break and a, you know, a bunch behind Keane, not to give them too much of a lead, it does, it just makes it hard for everybody. And we could see in that break that they were all working extremely hard. Here is Ben King at the summit a bit earlier. In the break again, and getting some King of the Mountains points there. Is that something you're thinking about?
I'm second in the competition. I was in the break. There were a lot of points up for grabs. You never know what can happen. I would hate to throw away the possibility if I found myself in one of the, you know, in a breakaway on a day with a lot of points up for grabs. It was a terrible day. I really didn't think I'd be in the break today. I did a lot of interviews before asking if I would be there today, and I said no because I'm close on the KOM, and because Kofidis has the KOM and a leader's jersey, I thought they wouldn't let me go. But Mate was also in the break, and you know, I said in the pre-race meeting, the breakaway was for Morawi and Igor today, but I said if things get crazy out there, then I'll definitely sniff around. And I saw Mollema jump with Mate and grab the wheel, and next thing you know, the virtual race leader again. Unfortunately, in the previous days I made the stage the real priority, and today I was really thinking about the possibility of climbing into the leader's jersey at the end of the day. Because only 3K steep in this climb, and I think if the other GC teams hadn't pitched in to help Kofidis, then I might be in a jersey right now. So
it looked hard in the break. I mean, it was a lot of good riders there, and it, you know, Bora especially were keeping the pace very high, weren't they?
My average power with zeros today was 300 watts for like 4.5 hours. So it was brutal. I'm pretty fried now, to be honest.
I'll not keep you too much longer, but Merhawi had a really good go there. He went after Micah when he jumped, and it just seemed to, you know, the road was just a little bit too steep, and he'd obviously made a big effort and paid for it.
Merhawi likes a steadier pace, I think. He's quite explosive, but that was my idea kind of in the beginning, to try to draw out some guys when a little lull, like 2.5K to go, so I jumped a little bit, and then was hoping it would just kind of set Morawi up and maybe draw out some of the other guys too early, that he could ride his own pace. But all in all, we're happy with the day. We kind of achieved our objectives. This climb is always going to be too steep for me, so yeah.
So that was Ben King, and the effort of the day clearly written across his face, evident in the way he was speaking, and evident also on his power meter. Live corrections corner here, Daniel. I think I'm going to be eating a little bit of humble pie here.
Well, Rich, it was 1983, the year when the Lagos de Covadonga, then known as the Lagos de Enol, were climbed in the Vuelta. The winner was Marino Lejarreta. Bernardino, in the battle between the favourites behind, put in a very distinguished performance. And he was the rider. He's responsible for this moniker of Spain's Alp d'Huez, because he compared it to Alp d'Huez in interviews after the race.
And what's confusing me is that Luis Herrera did then win at Alp d'Huez in 1984, not at Lagos de Covadonga, but he did win at Lagos de Covadonga in 1987 when he won the Vuelta, and in 1991.
Do you know what else about the Lagos de Covadonga? We shouldn't really even be talking about this because it's
2 days away.
It's 2 days away, but I think I'm right in saying it was the first live broadcast of the Vuelta a España.
Well, they're also the Alpe d'Huez of the Vuelta, because the first live broadcast from the Tour de France was on Alpe d'Huez, was it not, in 1952?
Yes, gosh, Rich, Corrections Corner is going to consume the whole podcast tomorrow. When the 1983, I said that Lagos de Covadonga was the first stage. That was the first edition that was broadcast live on Spanish TV, 1983.
Apologies to everyone for this pretty eccentric bit of podcasting from the stage 13 of the Vuelta. What else did we learn today, Daniel? Who's going to win? Because the point is that, Tommy Yates made this point a couple of days ago, this was the second GC day on the Vuelta, amazingly, almost 2 weeks into the race. So we've not really had any kind of idea about who was going to emerge as the strongest rider. Do we know today? I mean, I think it's Quintana, but...
Yeah, I think it is Quintana possibly at the moment. I think we found out the names of a few riders who are not going to win the Vuelta, who potentially this morning were still in with a shout. I don't think George Bennett is going to win the Vuelta now. Stephen Kreiswijk did okay, but he wasn't up there with Yates and Quintana. Again, perhaps wasn't his climb. Uran is still flying under the radar and going pretty well, and he defended himself very well today, as did Tony Gallopin, who's really surprising me. I think he thought today was going to be his Waterloo and that he was going to fall out of the general classification definitively today, but that wasn't the case. I think it will happen, unfortunately, for old Tony, who's a very good talker.
Thibaut Pinot,
well, I think, unfortunately...
Not his climb, is it?
It's not his climb. I think he'd fallen out of contention earlier on in the Vuelta. He was probably the first of the genuine overall contenders to be out of the race for the GC. You can never rule anything out, as we saw with Chris Froome at the Giro early this year. And I think Pinot will ride aggressively, but he has not generally been that happy with his form. He thought he would go slightly better. But, you know, a lot of climbing still to do, and Pino did say at the start of the Vuelta he was really targeting a stage win and a good preparation for the World Championships, which he might still get.
Well, the Spaniard on the French team, Jesus Hurada, who saw his lead cut today in the overall classification, Fran caught up with his Directeur Sportif Christian Guiberteau at the finish, and they had a difficult day, obviously defending that jersey with a team not really selected to defend a red jersey, but they did well, and here's what you had to say at the finish.
So, first day red, how was it?
It was really a difficult stage for sure, huh? With a big group on the incredible speed on to control on the... We are happy some teams come in the first call of the day, and after we continue with Movistar, and great job for the boys on the keep Jose, but not easy.
Yeah, but it was a tough ask, because after all, Nasser Wuan is at home, Luis Ángel Mategas on the breakaway, and Jesús Herrado, of course, was the leader, so you had to control the race with only five riders.
Yeah, sure. And we have also a team a bit for the sprint, on the Loïc Chéteau, on the Kenneth Van Bilsen, are guys who normally make a sprint, and for pool in the mountain, it's not really the for them really easy. And after we made a plan with Stéphane Rossetto, it's a good puller, and he make a really, really great job. And with Mathias, young guys, his first Grand Tour, who give bottles to Jesus, and we try to do what we can do. And it's a great job. The boys learn a lot.
By the feeling that you gather from Jesus Herrada in this climb today, do you think he will be able to keep the leader jersey tomorrow?
Each day we will see. One day it's already good this evening, but we will see for sure. But for sure, it's a difficult to keep a long time.
Chute à l'arrière du peloton. Cycling podcast team car at the back of the pack, please.
The familiar voice of Seb Piquet there reminding me to tell you that tonight's episode is sponsored by The Economist. The Economist is about far more than just economics and finance. It covers a range of subjects from politics and business to science, technology, the arts and the environment. The Economist helps readers prepare for what is going on in the world around them, and in today's dynamic world, facts matter more than ever. You can get a free copy delivered to your door if you live in the UK by texting the word cycling to 78070. Now, I've been reading The Economist this week at the Vuelta, and one story that certainly caught my eye was about nudity. Bear with me here, no pun intended, but this is all about Europe's taste for bare skin being in retreat. Nudist beaches and resorts, topless sunbathing, and nude unisex saunas are declining. Football teams report that players are unwilling to remove their underwear to shower after matches. There is, it seems, a new prudishness. But why? One reason, says The Economist, is the rise of social media, which had two effects. One, making young people more body conscious, and the second being the ubiquity of smartphones with cameras, making public undress more risky, as well as more risque. Also, says the magazine, the Me Too movement has forced a reassessment of even fully clothed interactions, let alone naked ones. But all is not lost if public nudity is your thing. It's getting a new lease of life, says The Economist. In some places, there are new hipster-style public saunas in Finland. I imagine Daniel Freeb would like them. And in Sweden, too, new mixed-sex saunas are opening. And in France, nude bowling nights are apparently packed, though overwhelmingly, says the report, with men. I do love the fact that stories like this are given such sober analysis in The Economist, which of course is the smart guide to the forces changing your world. You can get a free copy delivered to your door by texting the word cycling to 78070. We've been joined by Fran Reyes. Hello, Fran.
Hello, Richard. Hello, Daniel. Hello, listeners.
Well, you've been busy, Fran, speaking to lots of people because you know the winner, Oscar Rodriguez, very well, don't you?
Yeah, well, he raced for the second team where I work as a press officer, Equipo Lizarte, under 33, feeder team for Movistar team. We shared the team for a year, a very intense year where we shared room many nights. We got to build a pretty good friendship. So, yeah, this is a touching day for me.
I mean, be honest though, did you see that coming? Did you see him winning up here?
No, not at all. I mean, consider the guys who were on the breakaway today. They were some of the best climbers of the World Tour. Pretty solid guys, well suited for this kind of climb. Dylan Toyns, who is a guy who has been in Flèche Wallonne, which is a race basically decided in this kind of double-digit gradients. Marawi Kudus, which hits frantic cadence. Rafał Majka, with all his pedigree, in Urtzakarin. It's a very long list of riders who, in theory, had a best chance of winning today. Yet, well, Oscar is a very light climber, one who knows himself quite well, who, in this point of his career, is pretty confident on his possibilities. And he kept a cool head in order to climb with a steady pace and overtake, one by one, all the riders that began the climb with an upper pace that later took its soul.
Was that what it was, Dan? I mean, Micah, did he just get it wrong? He went very early on the climb, didn't he?
Yeah, I think possibly. I didn't speak to Micah at the end. I spoke to Toyns, but having seen his team do so much work, and the goal there was not just to set a high pace, it was really to ensure that the front group was contesting a stage win. I can imagine in that situation, you possibly, your focus goes on to, you know, how much time you've got over the peloton and how your team is working at the front, and you might stop thinking and stop concentrating in quite the same way on how you're going to manage your effort on the climb. You might feel under a lot of pressure at that point because Bora had, you know, they'd teed it up, hadn't they? They'd laid it on perfectly for him. So who knows whether it was a question of effort management or he's not perhaps in the best form at the moment, but I mean, he looked to have all the credentials, certainly at the bottom of that climb, to win quite comfortably.
It's an interesting point, the pressure that you feel to, you know, to be the guy that really takes it on as soon as the climb starts. And it's such a difficult climb to judge your effort on when it's as steep as that. And if you get it just a little bit wrong, you will pay for that.
I think that's key. I think everyone, including probably Bora, including Mike himself, expected that group to hit the bottom of the climb and for him to, you know, as I say, his team had done all the work and then it was time for him to come to the fore. And that's what happened. He attacked very early, possibly didn't need to do that. And, you know, certainly given the pedigree of some of the climbers in that group, there wasn't much room for error. If he got it wrong, he was not going to win the stage, and he did ultimately get it wrong. The big surprise is the rider who beat him.
I mean, can clear up a bit of confusion for some people over the team, Fran, because everybody remembers Euskaltel Euskadi team, the team in orange for many years. They went to the wall a few years ago. Then this new team emerged, Euskadi Murias, using the same name, obviously. But there's another team that Mikel Landa owns. Well, he's taken over the Euskadi Foundation, hasn't he? Which previously was the body that ran the Euskaltel team, or Euskaltel Euskadi team. But Euskadi Murias, or Murias Euskadi, is a completely separate entity, isn't it?
Exactly. Euskadi Murias was a Basque cycling project that was born in order to take the baton from the Fundación Euskadi, which after the Euskaltel decided to pull out of the sponsorship, was laid without resources. They kept the team in the continental level for a year or two, I'm not sure, but they couldn't quite manage, they couldn't stand that position, so they had to give it up and return to the amateur ranks. At the same time, John Odriozola, former Basque rider who rode for Banesto, Kelme and Jeguis at the beginning of his career, was working on setting up a new Basque structure. He managed to put together three sponsors that committed to fund a pro-continental team. Yet in the last minute, two of them pulled out and only one decided to go ahead and create the continental team, Murias, in 2015.
What is Murias?
Murias is a holding company. It has different businesses, but the main one is construction, buildings, civil buildings, and this kind of stuff, roads. You get the point. During these 3 years, they have been seeking this second company to sponsor the team in order to step up to the pro-continental level. They didn't find it, so they did the step on their own this year, and they chose to put the name Euskadi before Murias as title sponsor, not because of getting any money from the public institutions of the Basque country, but only as an attempt to undermine any possible try from the Fundación Euskadi to make it bad and claim this herald position of Basque cycling.
So is there a bit of rivalry there between those two teams?
Exactly. I mean, this season we haven't quite seen that expressed on the road because, of course, Fundación Euskadi, they returned back to the continental level thanks to the decisive push of Mikel Landa. But they are one or two steps below in terms of sporting level. But in the coming years, if the Fundación Euskadi manages to attract the resources and the sponsorship necessary in order to become pro-continental again, we might see some very interesting clashes on the road as well as in the offices where there have been many.
Well, Euskadi Murias certainly are ahead now thanks to a stage win at the Vuelta today. Somebody I saw point out on Twitter, it means that a Basque rider has won a stage in each of the Grand Tours this year, Giro, Tour de France, and now this with Mikel Nieve at the Giro, Omar Fraile at the Tour de France, and now, well, somebody that nobody would have picked. You spoke, I think, to Oscar and to maybe a teammate management at the finish?
Well, I spoke to Oscar, but unfortunately my recorder ran out of battery. Afterwards, I spoke to Eduard Prades with my iPhone, and we can listen to that in order to get the vibe on how the team lived this success. Edu Prades, ciclista de Euskadi Muria. Cuéntanos, tío, para un equipo como este, ¿qué significa una victoria?
What does a victory like this mean for a team like yours?
This is the best we could possibly achieve. It's extraordinary to get a win like this in our first year as a Pro Conti team, in our first Vuelta. It's unbelievable.
When you saw yourself in Breakaway with Oscar, could you see this happening?
Actually, we were told the peloton was coming back to us, so we were hesitant. But we knew that if we made it to the bottom of the climb with an advantage, we had a shot. We know we're in good shape and that we're not inferior to World Tour riders. We intended to fight for victory and prove that the World Tour is not as far away as it seems.
What can you tell us about Oscar Rodriguez?
He's a very young guy, very dedicated, with great qualities and a good engine. But above all, he's classy and a very nice guy.
The Cycling Podcast is supported by Science in Sport.
Whether you're grinding up the French Alps or just taking your mates on around a local loop, Science in Sport Rego Rapid Recovery Plus will help you recover faster after your ride, so you're ready to go again the next day.
Science in Sport, fueled by science.
We were played in there by some Emmanuel Buchmann fans who were camped out on the climb, and they were still there an hour or so after the race had finished, and when we were coming back down the mountain, we're now at our hotel, Fran. Before we heard the Bookman Army, we heard this the message from Science and Sport, and thank you very much to Science and Sport for sponsoring the cycling podcast. And you can get your 25% off at scienceandsport.com with the code SISCP25. Now, returning to yesterday's events, because there was a nasty crash, obviously, at the finish, involving the winner, Alexander Geniez, and Dylan van Baarle, who was particularly badly hurt, and Dylan Teuns as well, came off and was obviously up the road again today. And, I mean, the fallout from that continued. There were some of the riders were quite unhappy. I spoke to Marcus Burghardt. We'll hear from him in a moment this morning. He was particularly unhappy about what had happened. There were two things, I suppose. There was an official got in the way. Now, Fran, you know the official pretty well, and he has actually resigned today as a result of this, hasn't he?
Yeah, well, the official is Chema Rodriguez. He's a cycling journalist, legendary cycling journalist here in Spain. He's been around forever, has set up several cycling media back in the analogic era, and afterwards he quitted his last newspaper Meta 2000 to be the press officer of Carlos Sastre during the most successful part of his career, and yeah, he retired several years ago but still came to do this job at La Vuelta.
So how long had he done this job at the Vuelta, because his job is to organize the finish area, which means making sure the photographers are where they should be. Mm-hmm. The journalists are where they should be, and the finish line is clear for the riders. How long has he done that?
Well, he's been doing that for at least 8 years, and I presume it's up to 10. But well, he was quite positive that it was going to be his last Vuelta. That he, after this, he was quitting the sport completely. And this unfortunate event that happened yesterday, he decided to resigned, and well, the organization of the race has accepted.
Yeah, I'm going to say something that might be quite unpopular, and I don't know him at all, but I think he's very unlucky here, because clearly what he was doing was clearing an obstacle further up on the finishing straight. Mm-hmm. He was not responsible for that narrow finishing straight. He's not the course designer. You know, he has to work with the tools that he's given, which is the layout of the finish straight as it's decided upon by the race organisers. I think he had an impossible job there. It was too narrow. We could have seen something far worse if it had been a bigger group coming to finish. We talked about this a bit last night. But you see, you know, unfortunately these days people look for somebody to blame, and perhaps he was at fault. Certainly when he turned around, when he was shouted at by Genier, as he turned around and kind of went into their path, that was a mistake. But we all make mistakes, and you know, it was... It was a very difficult situation, but I think the clamour to blame him and jump on him is perhaps unfortunate, because I don't feel that he was the person mainly responsible for what happened.
Yeah, I would go a bit further and say it is not only unfortunate but also unfair. There are several parents to victory, and there are several parents also to failure. And in this case, what I've been hearing and collecting, there are a handful of versions of what really happened that triggered everything. Of course, we have a finish line that we can discuss whether it was suitable or not to host a cycling race, a cycling event of the size of La Vuelta. In this case, I was told today by two sources that there was a lot of confusion yesterday because some police officials decided that two cars had to go through the finish line instead of taking the deviation that was
set before
the finish line. And because of these claims, Chema had to go down there to clear things up, make sure that no car was going through the finish line because there was no space for it. And it was in that chain of events that he was caught by surprise by the arrival of the riders, because with the riders, no motorbike, no cars arrived before them. So he basically turned back to watch the final stride and found the riders coming at him. He couldn't stand where he was because he would have avoided the photographers
doing their job. So he chose
You can see he didn't want to get in the way of the photographers, and he was in an impossible situation. But as I say, I think the finish was too narrow. And at the finish today, I saw Javier Guillen, the race director, the Vuelta director. I know he speaks very good English, Javier Guillen, because I interviewed him last year, but he didn't want to answer the question in English, but he did answer the second question in English. So we'll hear initially him in Spanish and then in English.
I'm going to ask you about the finish yesterday. Obviously, a few of the riders unhappy at how narrow it was. Was that your thought in looking at what happened there as well?
Bueno, yo creo que es verdad que era una llegada estrecha, pero
I think it's true that it was a narrow finish, but the fact is there was a human mistake and the accident happened. Just because one official got in the way of the riders, that has nothing to do with the finish being narrow or not. Furthermore, I'd say that if nothing had happened, we would not be speaking about it. Maybe someone would have had an opinion, but nothing more. We knew the situation of the race was going to be similar to what it was, that the race would be split up. We worked to ensure the best possible conditions. What happened here was just unfortunate. A human mistake, which of course has consequences.
Pero no creo que una situación de carretera distinta ayer hubiera podido evitar lo que pasó.
Any regrets about it?
For sure, regrets, because you know, you never want this kind of thing happens. For sure, the guy who was working for the organization is the first one that never wanted that. I have to remind that he was the more damaged guy there. Fortunately, him and the rest of the riders are all okay. But, you know, regret what happened. But at the end, we are a human being. We are subject to this kind of things. And for sure, we try to work. Never happen again. But, you know, I cannot ensure that we are going to be stop being human beings.
So that was Javier Guillen disagreeing that the finish was dangerous. And I have to say, sort of putting the blame on the race official, I think, if not explicitly, then implicitly. I also spoke to a couple of riders this morning who had an interest in what happened. Marcus Burkhardt was quite critical on Twitter, so I went and spoke to him about it. And also Michael Morkov, the Quickstep rider, lead-out man for Elia Viviani. I also asked him about the CPA, because they came out quite angry through their president, Gianni Bugno. David Miller announced yesterday that he was standing to be president of the CPA, and the CPA is a riders' association that represents their interests, and especially in things like safety. So let's hear first from Marcus Burkhardt and then from Michael Morkov.
I saw directly that it's way too narrow. I mean, we were thinking in the start maybe to go for a sprint. If we go for a sprint there, it's going to be a nightmare, because if there's something happening, there's no way for other riders to escape on a road where three riders fit next to each other. And I mean, this was not the right spot to make a finish. Okay, maybe the town likes it there, but nobody thought about our health on a finish like this. You come in downhill with big speed, and this was not good. And for me, the Vuelta did already some mistakes in this last 11 days. If we think on the finish with the crosswind, where there was a sign not protected right, there was with the helicopter, there was a finish where Kwiatkowski crashed on a bad road, and this is not good what they do.
Have you heard anything from the Vuelta organization about it?
No, or? I was hoping that they explain about this. For me, this would be the minimum that they maybe even excuse that this maybe was not the right finish. I think it should have been the way.
By coincidence, David Miller has announced that he's standing for CPA president. Is the CPA, do you think, an effective body? Would you support David Miller or somebody else to make it a bit more powerful in terms of the voice it has?
Yeah, but how long we are speaking about this? I was speaking with Bernie Eisel about this also, because we have the CPA so long already, and the things happen and happen again and again. And I don't know. I hope that he can make the change, but we cannot live always from excuses and sorries, because there needs to happen something. And this I am really missing.
When I arrived at the finish yesterday, obviously I realized that it was lucky we didn't arrive in a bunch sprint, which could have been a possibility. I mean, You can never tell before the race what will happen. But could also be 20 guys arriving for a sprint, and that road was just too small for a proper race and a proper result, in my opinion. Luckily, it turned out well, except of the small crash after the finish line. In terms of the CPA, I mean, it's also for me a general problem since 10 years in cycling that we have no rider organization, we have no... we cannot stand together in any points. We have UCI is their own part. It's just always a political fight all the way around. Nobody do any adult decision. And yeah, the CPA always show up with some guy, but for me, it's not really for anything.
David Miller, do you think he could be the man to lead a more powerful CPA with a slightly stronger voice?
I don't know, but since I don't fancy CPA that much, because I don't think I never seen on paper or visual any good things they really did. I will always be up for a change. I think we already spent a lot of money for the CPA, and I would, as a rider, be happy to see some more value for the money. And I don't know with David how he would be as a president, obviously, but I think a change could be good for us.
So that was Burghardt and Murkov, and you know, Burghardt pretty angry about it, but not too angry to not play a very important part in today's stage. He was in that break and really did a power of work for Rafał Majka. It didn't pay off in the end, but you know, he was a very important teammate for Rafał Majka today. Just before we go, Fran, we were going to look ahead briefly to tomorrow's stage. We've already, in the first part of this podcast with Daniel, looked ahead to Lagos de Covadonga on Sunday, which seems a bit odd, but we did find ourselves talking about that. But what can we expect tomorrow? Because another difficult stage tomorrow.
Well, tomorrow is one typical Asturian stage, you know, with lots of up and downs, real mountains, because here you have... Here in Asturias, we have the Picos de Europa, which is one of the many sierras in Cordillera Cantabrica. Quite lumpy terrain, quite sharp climbs, quite beautiful to see also, because there is green everywhere. The stage is going to be uncomfortable, but of course, the highlight is the final climb to Les Praeres de Nava. This is a national park, which got one of their gravel roads resurfaced, repaved, in order to host this stage of La Vuelta. So it's going to be interesting. It's one of these cases when one wonders if cycling, in their intention, you know, their will of showcasing the beauties of the country and the beauties of nature, maybe it has a negative impact in the environment, because of course this national park until now was pretty much virgin, and now it has been resurfaced, it is bound to become a hotbed for cycling, and that might harm nature after all.
Well, it's not the most environmentally friendly sport, is it, cycling? We've had these discussions around various climbs and repaving of roads in the in the Tour de France as well, in the Alps. It's a perennial problem, but I'm sure it'll be a beautiful stage and another decisive one. And we look forward to it. Before we go, press conference on Monday. We're inviting your questions. Please send us a WhatsApp voice memo at the number +44 7971 338 205. Got lots of questions already, but send us your questions and myself, Fran, Lionel, maybe Daniel as well, will endeavour to answer them on Monday. That's +44 7971 338 205.
Please, I want hard questions.
Hard questions.
Don't be afraid.
We've actually had a hard question already. Well, somebody, I'll not mention who, somebody emailed in a very, very hard question. He was very angry about something that was said in the podcast in week one. So it wasn't me. I can't tell you what it was, but we we emailed him back and asked him to leave a voice message. So I hope you do that. If you know who you are, if you're listening, do it. One more thing, friend of the podcast prize draw. Sign up to become a friend of the podcast, and you could, well, you'll go in the hat to win some Rafa and Science and Sports swag. And all existing friends in 2018 will be in that draw as well. Sign up at thecyclingpodcast.com. That's all for tonight. We'll be back tomorrow. Thank you very much, Fran.
Thank you very much, Richard.